Welcome back. Welcome back. And welcome to our third installment in our series of the book of 1 Peter titled Intact. And just to kind of give you a snapshot overview of this letter, in essence, this letter that God inspired Peter to write to the church during the first century is it's God's response to a people who find themselves amidst some challenges in their lives, deep struggle, adversity, turmoil. There's some persecution going on. There's some challenge going on with regards to being a Christian in the first century. There's some political tension. If you were a believer during that time, it would have been common for you to see your fellow believers burned at the stake. Politically, there was a lot of heat being brought against the church. And so if you were following Jesus during the first century, in essence, what was being challenged was your value system, in that your social status, your relationships, all the way down to your livelihood was on the chopping block, per se. And so today what we're going to do is we're going to work through chapter 1, verses 6 through 9, and what we're going to be attempting to do is apply what we've learned during the first 2 weeks about who we are in Jesus, the new identity that we have as a result of His finished work. And in addition, we're going to begin applying what we have in Jesus, a new hope and a new security, to the challenges and the circumstances and the fires that we face in life. And what I want to help you see this morning is that Jesus is, He's going to keep us. He has promised to keep us. He will keep us intact, not despite of, but through our struggles. And I'm talking the loss of loved ones, debilitating fatal illnesses, people succumbing to addictions, people that are caught in moral failure or relational turmoil, whatever the challenge, intact, not despite it, but through it, regardless of what you're going through. And I'll just say this as well. If you're a person that's looking at your life and you're like, well, I really don't have a lot of adversity in my life, or I really don't have a lot of struggle today, this message still applies to you. And the reason why is adversity is right around the corner. Your road is bound to fork at a certain point in time, and you're going to have no choice but to take the road of adversity. You don't know what the next day brings. You're not sure what the next bend around the road brings. Challenge and tragedy are right around the corner. I would liken it to this. If I look at my life in a general sense, the ground seems pretty flat and vast, and I got a lot of room to navigate. But it's more like I'm walking on a tightrope that I can't sense or see all the time. Or there's like this underpinning quaking of the earth that at any given moment could just erupt and derail everything that I thought I had going for me. But know this, church, fellow followers of Jesus. Life might be fragile and filled with tragedy, but God is all about turning your tragedy into triumph. He is all about taking your dead end and turning it into a doorway. And He is all about looking at the opposition that you face and creating opportunity amidst it, because God is fully invested in taking every, absolutely every detail of our lives that's good, that's bad, that's ugly, and using it for good. He's working all aspects of our reality together for good. So there's nothing trivial about your trial. There's nothing trivial about the tragedy or the struggle that we might find ourselves in. So turn to me to 1 Peter chapter 1. We're going to take a look at verses 6 through 9. And here's what Peter says. You rejoice in this, though now for a short time you have had to struggle in various trials, so that the genuineness of your faith, more valuable than gold, which perishes though refined by fire, may result in praise, glory, and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. You love Him, though you have not seen Him, and though not seeing Him now, you believe in Him and rejoice with an inexpressible and glorious joy, because you are receiving the goal of your faith, the salvation of your souls. So in a sense, Peter is highlighting the attitude of a community of believers in that they know who they are in Jesus and they know what they have in Jesus, and they're leveraging that through all kinds of suffering and trials, and they're leveraging it to the degree to where they're not debilitated by their trials, they're actually rejoicing through them. These are people that, as I mentioned earlier, they're in the throes of life, they're in the thick of struggle, some serious, painful, grueling struggles, yet somehow, and I know you've been amidst some serious struggles, I know I've been there, somehow they're finding the poise to rejoice in Jesus. And so I think it'd be helpful if we took a look at the actual meaning of that word struggle that we find in this text, because I think it will shed some light on how we're to interpret what Peter tells us. And so the word struggle here literally means mental or emotional distress. Who hasn't been there? Because we want to give you a t-shirt. Just kidding. Stop by the info station before you leave and I'm just kidding. Who hasn't been there? The reality is we've all been there. And if you haven't been there, the people that have gone before you, all they're going to do is say, put your seatbelt on because you're going to be there sometime or another. And so literally that word means severe mental or emotional distress. And did you know that this is the same phrase that we hear Jesus using when he's in the Garden of Gethsemane and he's staring down the barrel of the most crazy, struggle-oriented, challenging thing that anyone has ever endured. He's staring down the barrel of his own execution, and here's what he says. He says, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. And then he goes on to say, he's in emotional distress at this point in time. My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it. He's talking about the cup of God's wrath, the death that he is going to endure to secure our identity and our future and our hope as his followers. He says, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done. Jesus was wrecked emotionally, yet he was rejoicing. And maybe you're having a hard time seeing that, because if you're familiar with this story, or if you were a disciple that was there with him, you would have seen your rabbi, your leader, sweating droplets of blood in total anguish. Like it almost would have been like Jesus is coming unraveled. He steps away from complete failure. But that was not the case. Somehow, the struggle that he was going through was actually strengthening him. And here's why I say that Jesus was rejoicing. If you look at Hebrews 12, verse 2, here's what you'll find. It says that Jesus is the author that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. So here we have Jesus facing the greatest struggle in the history of humanity, and we're told that he faced it. He endured it. He went through it with joy. And I'm not talking about an emotional happiness, which is, I kind of think that's kind of where our minds tend to go when we think of joy. It's like it's this emotional happiness. But it's not an emotional happiness. What the rejoicing is that Peter is referencing, that Jesus is experiencing, is it's a deep sense of confidence in God and a deep sense of purpose in God. And so we cannot afford to rejoice or to reduce rejoicing to a bunch of emotional sentiments or an emotional response, because that's not what it is. And that might sound crazy because, like you, I live amidst a culture that is driven by emotions. And I think when we think of emotions, you think of someone who's emotionally stable as someone who can maintain a level of happiness. Right? You don't think of people who have emotional stability as the guy that's grappling with depression or sadness. It's kind of like an either or. You're either happy or you're sad. You're either stoked or you're not. But you got to keep in mind that the Bible makes distinctions between the state of our hearts and our emotions. And when the Bible mentions our hearts, it talks about our hearts as the center, the wellspring, the dwelling place of our deepest commitments, our deepest trusts, our deepest hopes, and our deepest loves. And so to rejoice in God is to maintain focus on and remind and what God has done. Here's the challenge. Sometimes when I do that, sometimes when we do that, our emotions follow and we feel really, really good. We feel emotionally happy. We feel emotionally high. We feel like we've never felt before. And that's sometimes. It's not all the time. But sometimes our emotions do not respond in the presence of our doubt, our weakness, our pain, our struggle. Like emotionally, we're crushed. But I see Jesus rejoicing through the greatest struggle that anyone has ever endured. The greatest struggle of his life. He's experiencing emotional turmoil while simultaneously rejoicing in God himself. And I see this. I hear Jesus saying, God, this is painful. It's emotionally challenging and exhausting, and it's outright dangerous. But I do not see Jesus being taken captive by his emotions. I see Jesus processing his emotions through the lens of who God is and what God's purpose is. And I see Jesus not being shattered by his struggle, but being strengthened as a result of his struggle. And so I know I have a tendency to do this, so I'll just throw this out there. I think that as human beings, we have a tendency to deny or create feelings. You ever denied or created feelings? Where you were like, well, I have to feel happy because those people are celebrating or what have you. Or you suppress something. You're like, and you don't want to face the pain. You don't want to face the grief or the agony or the hurt. And so we deny the feeling, or we suppress the feeling, or we conjure up a feeling that really doesn't, externally, it doesn't match what's going on inside of us. Or we're facing like a big challenge and we muscle up, we put our chin up, keep our nose up, and we say, I got this. And we navigate through the most challenging season of life as if we're strong enough to face it on our own. And just hear me on this. When we do that, is that not prideful? Is that not us really just being self-absorbed? Taking it on our own? You know, trying to bear the weight on our own? Pretending as if we're too strong to be impacted by the struggle that we're in? Look, we've all been there, and struggles, they make us feel weak. They beat us down. That's emotionally, that's physically, spiritually, relationally. And to deny that we hurt or have been hurt is outside of the range of what God would have us do or the lives that he would have us live. To tell ourselves that we're just fine is not the answer. It's actually one of the most dangerous games that we can play, and here's why. Sooner or later, you're going to reach a breaking point. You're going to lose it. You're going to blow up. You're going to fall apart. And only then are you going to begin to realize that you never were as strong as you thought you were. That we were only kidding ourselves. That we hurt more than we wanted to or thought we did. Despite the fact that we kept our chin up and we smiled through the storm and we flexed on our problems as if we were going to conquer them. So I recently ran across someone that I hadn't seen in a couple of decades, and this was like a really good childhood friend. I mean, we did all kinds of things together, and I'll just leave it at that. Some of them were amazing. Some of them were, you know, I don't know how we made it out of there alive. And some of them I've yet to confess to my parents, so I'm a work in progress. But I hadn't seen this individual in 2 decades. And so he kind of, when I saw him, he kind of gave me the scoop on a bunch of people that I thought I had forgot, and I started remembering, and he let me know where people were at, who was alive, who was not alive, who was incarcerated, who had seen success. It was like the whole gamut. And he spent a lot of time in the context of my home. We took vacations with him. We took him along on our family vacations, rather. And I spent a lot of time in his home as well. So we had relationships with each other's parents. And so my curiosity was pricked in that he didn't mention his parents at all. So I just went ahead and asked him. I was like, hey, how are your folks doing? And for the past 20 years, his dad has been grappling with a drug addiction that has, it just has both hands around his neck. Weighs about 120 pounds now. He was showing me pictures and video of his dad. His dad does not look like the man that we looked up to and respected and talked with as kids. His dad has been taken captive by a substance abuse problem. And so he kind of brought me up to speed there, and I asked him, I said, well, how are you doing with all of that? You know, what's going on in your head as you see your dad being transformed in a way that's not healthy? And he said, doesn't bother me. I've already processed it. Doesn't bother me at all. Which, sir, I don't think that that's healthy, but I did internalize that. And there is no way under the sun you can watch someone that you love be untethered and destroyed by something such as a substance abuse problem and it not hurt you or impact you. There is no way that you can be crying out to God for your adolescent child to come back home and they're not coming back home and not be impacted by that. We are not that strong. We are not that armored. We are not that tough. And so I'm praying for my friend. I'm praying that he would begin to process what he's been through and that he would see God in the pain and in the struggle. But Peter is not telling us to do what my friend is doing. He's not telling us to deny the struggle. He's not telling us to protect. In 7, Peter is not saying, you used to rejoice in Jesus, but you're going through a season and you'll get back to a place where you can rejoice in Jesus, but just hold back for now. He's not saying, put pause on rejoicing Jesus as you go through a painful season. He's not saying, hang in there, you'll do it all again. You'll feel connected to God again. He's not saying, you can either rejoice in Jesus or cry out in calamity. He's not saying that. He's putting these two behaviors, these two activities together. He's saying that we can do both. And in a sense, he's saying if you don't do both, you're not going to make it. You've got to do both. Because your struggles are either going to shatter you to pieces or they're going to strengthen you. The struggle that you might find yourself in this season, it's not designed to shatter you. It's designed to strengthen you. And the first thing that I want to present you with is that idea that God designs the struggles in our lives to strengthen our faith. Listen to verse 6. Peter says, you rejoice in this, though now for a short time you have had to struggle in various trials, so that the genuineness of your faith, more valuable than gold, which pays glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So Peter he's using an analogy to paint a picture for us. And the analogy he's using is a fiery furnace. And if you're familiar with a fiery furnace, you know that things put into a fiery furnace can either be destroyed, they can be shaped, they can be purified, or they can be refined. And so I'll say this, that mixed in my faith in Jesus, and I'll argue that probably mixed in your faith in Jesus or your faith in God are all sorts of competing commitments for comfort, power, pride, self, and you can fill in the blank however your life would have you fill in the blank. But there are all kinds of competing forces in our lives in addition to the faith that we have in Jesus. And a lot of times, our faith, my faith, it's like this abstract thing that lives up here, and I can easily say that I'm a sinner saved by grace, and Jesus paid it all, and all of my sins have been removed from me, but I still, at times, live under the premise that the only reason I'm doing good is because of my morality, or my ability to comply with what I think God has told me to do, or the life that I believe God's told me to live, or that I'm maybe more open-minded than the people around me, or maybe I feel more sophisticated than the people around me. Can you relate? Can you relate to that? Or that I'm mean sometimes to the people that I say that I love? Or that relation in the context of some of the relationships that I'm in, I'm the problem? Despite the fact that Jesus has made me new? Or let me ask you this. Why is criticism such a hard thing? Why does it bend you out of shape? Why does it bend me out of shape? If I'm so secure in Jesus, if my faith is so strong, Why does it put me at odds with people? Or let me ask you this. Why does traffic bum you out? Why? Why do those like tail lights that seem to be going on forever, indefinitely, perpetually, until Jesus comes back, make you angry? Or why do you get upset when somebody like swoops in and they scooped up your parking space? These are like small-scale things that become catastrophic events in our minds. And all the while, we're following Jesus. So I'm going to argue that Peter is onto something when he says, hey guys, your faith, it needs to be refined. You might be brand spanking new in Jesus, but he's still doing a work in you and will continue doing a work in you until the day that he calls you home. And so here's what happens. Struggles come our way because the problem isn't that we're any of those things. It's not that we respond poorly to criticism or we dole it out in anger. It's not that we have a hard time forgiving people or loving people or being generous. It's none of that. The problem is a lot of times we're blind to it. And God inserts a struggle into our lives. And in that moment, when you're going through it, your timidity, our cowardice, our selfishness, our self-absorption, our bitterness, our ability to be completely dishonest, to protect our own identity or to protect our own rapport or our street credibility, it all comes to the forefront. And finally, we're getting a glimpse of who we are. We're getting a glimpse that, hey, there's a lot of growth that needs to happen in our own personal lives. And so like fire working on a piece of gold in a furnace, suffering can destroy the impurities in our life and purify and strengthen other areas of our lives. But know this, this is probably the best part of it all. God is not unaware of any of the impurities in your life, your inability to believe him at all costs, the things that you're still struggling with, that area of your life that you really have no idea how you're going to get over, your doubts, your fears, the parts of you that are still at odds with God. God knows all of that. And he's still committed. He's committed to transforming our lives. And he's capable of using absolutely anything to do so, even those things that terrify us. Because he's working all things together for good. And Peter wants us to see that God uses our struggles to strengthen our faith, to make us more like Jesus. If you look at Jesus' life, there's struggle at the core of it. The whole thing is struggle. From his birth, to his childhood, to his manhood, to his ministry, every part of it, to his death, all of it is struggle. And so it's through struggle that Jesus became like us. It's through struggle that Jesus has redeemed us. And it's through struggle that we become more like Jesus. Listen to what Peter says. You have had to struggle in various trials so that the genuineness of your faith, more valuable than gold, which perishes though refined by fire, may result in praise, glory, and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. The faith that you want, the life that you want, it doesn't come by any other means than through struggle. And so that means this, that the pain of your struggles will absolutely never outweigh God's purpose for them. The struggle that you're going through right now, the struggle that you'll eventually go through, it's not designed to make you feel like a victim. It's designed to give you victory. It's not designed to shatter you. It's designed to strengthen you. It's designed to strengthen your identity and your faith in Jesus. And from there, it's designed to strengthen you emotionally and relationally. It's designed to help you reorient your priorities and your loves. It's designed to change your perspective. So walk with me for a second. About 5 years ago, my wife and I had received some pretty good news. You know, we were parents of three children at the time, three beautiful girls, and we received news that child number four was on her way. And we love kids. I mean, we have five of them. I'm not saying that I'm always happy around my kids, but I love my kids. And so I love on them a lot, and I repent a lot. But this was a season of rejoicing for us. Thanks. Some of you can relate. This was a season of rejoicing that pretty quickly transpired into becoming a season of great struggle and great challenge for us as a family. Because early into the pregnancy, my wife, she started to hemorrhage, okay? And she was bleeding profusely. And so when that happened, we raced to the emergency room and thank God for the medical personnel at emergency rooms, wherever they are. They are doing a work. They're doing a tremendous work, and we thank God for them. We thank God for that, the opportunity to hear our child's heartbeat through that, because that gave us a sense of hope and a sense of security, and that kind of got us on the other side of the struggle. But that struggle was not confined to that encounter in an emergency room. It was something that we were going to walk through for months on end. And what ended up happening is on the month of November, the hemorrhaging recurred. It happened all over again, and I'll never forget the phone call from my wife. God bless her. She was in the line to vote, and I'll just say this. She is a champion of champions. She's the glue that holds my family together, and I don't know what I would do without that woman. If you know her, cool, good on you. She's a great friend to have. If you don't know her, I dare you to get to know her. You'll be well pleased. But she came home, she stuck it out, like she stayed in line. She's bleeding, and she came home, and she's like, I voted, I still did my thing, and I refuse to tell you who she voted for. I'm not welcoming judgment. I'm not going to do that. But she was bleeding, and so we ended up in the hospital again. And what we found out is that she had a hemorrhage that wasn't going to go away, and it was going to threaten the life of this child that we wanted to see. We wanted to experience. We wanted to tell her about Jesus. We wanted to raise her up in the way that she would go. And so we were in a season of life where it was moment to moment. It was touch and go. And we were in and out of the obstetrician's office and specialist's office for the duration of this pregnancy. And then you fast forward to 30 weeks in. And we'd made it to 30 weeks, and I'm clocking in down at the middle school. I was a teacher at the time, and I got a phone call, and the phone call was, hey, we need you on the home front. And quite frankly, I love that phone call, because if you work in a middle school, or you're familiar with middle schoolers, no offense if you are one, y'all are some challenging people. I was a challenging person. So anyways, I race home. We go down to Anne Arundel Medical Center, where we were told that's where she was going to endure the duration of the pregnancy. My wife was put on bed rest after her water broke at 30 weeks. And again, it's touch and go, touch and go. However, during that time, all of the medical personnel were telling us, hey, it's going to be okay. It's going to be all right. Your daughter will be born via C-section. She'll spend a couple of days in the NICU. We'll high-five you on the way out, talk to you about car seats, and you'll go on your way as new parents of you know, new parents again, because when you have one and then you transition to two and three, and well, it's all new every time. There's a new learning curve. But I'll never forget this. A few days prior to this child's birth, I'm cruising northbound on 97 from Annapolis to our home in Severn. And I'm not a person that feels like they've heard from God audibly many times in their life, but I am convinced that God, he told me something on that commute. And he said some very simple things, and it was, get ready. It was kind of like, hunker down. And he wasn't talking about hunker down because having four kids is a challenge. He was talking about hunker down because the struggle is about to get all the more real. And moments after that child was born, I heard her try to cry, and I wanted her to cry so bad, and I wanted her to breathe on her own, but she was not breathing. And I watched panic fill the room. I watched people that were poised before go into panic mode as they tried to intubate her and keep her alive. I all but passed out as I watched this. My faith was being challenged through struggle, because I had a decision to make. It was either you're going to believe God in the outcome that he gives you, or you're going to be angry at God because he didn't give you what you thought you deserved. And so for the first 24 hours of our fourth daughter's life, it was We didn't know what was going to happen. It was to the point where we found ourselves at Johns Hopkins University with some of the most poised, professional, well-versed, well-trained doctors and nurses and respiratory therapists in the world. And they, because it's getting to that point. And that was a turning point. And so we said whatever it was that we said. I don't even think we could speak. We cried, we wept. All we wanted was a future that involved this child. And we went back to our room that night. And I'll never forget it. And we got a we had a nurse barge in there after having a little phone call. And she said to us, and this is granted after we had signed paperwork to put her on a machine that was going to bring her, keep her alive because her heart and lungs were failing. And she came in and said, "We're not doing that. Something crazy happened. We've hit a turning point. There's been a 180. And so I'm saying all that to say this. Through that, I had an outcome in mind. And thank God we got it. But there are people that have an outcome in mind right now, and you're not going to get it this side. We were bound to walk out of that hospital one person down. One child down, experiencing and lamenting loss. God turned it around. But I'm here to say that nothing caused me to stop in my tracks like that struggle and question everything that I thought I believed about God, about priorities, about family, about loving people the way that a struggle did. Nothing caused me to evaluate my life the way that a struggle did. So I say here with confidence, the life that you want, you are not going to get it outside of God's pathway of struggle. Going through struggle alone, it does not guarantee a net change in your life for the better. It really doesn't. We all have been through struggle, and some of us are scarred. We're wounded. We're hurt. It doesn't automatically make us better. But God tells us something that's extremely key in Isaiah 43. He says that he is going to walk with us through the fire. He is going to be with us through the struggle. And so walking with God through the struggle is the key to getting out of it and not being shattered, but being strengthened. Because trauma will shatter your beliefs. It will cause you to question everything. And if you try to pick up the pieces on your own, you're only going to be left feeling more vulnerable than when you started. And Peter is telling us that if we allow God to pick up the pieces and to lead through the struggles of life, we will end up with a faith more genuine than the one we've ever imagined. Because God doesn't just use our struggles to strengthen us. He uses our struggles to secure our souls. Listen to verses 8 and 9. You love him though you have not seen him, and though not seeing him now, you believe in him and rejoice with inexpressible and glorious joy because you are receiving the goal of your faith, the salvation of your souls. Peter is commending a posture when it comes to following Jesus, and that posture is this. Despite what is going on in your life, you can rejoice and have an unbelievable and glorious joy through it. This is not a posture that denies struggle. This is a posture that absolutely redefines struggle. They don't see their struggle as evidence of God's silence. They are looking at their struggle as evidence of God's steadfast commitment to securing their souls. They rejoice through the struggle because of what God is doing in it. He's securing the goal of their faith, the salvation of their souls. But I'm not going to pretend up here. I'm not going to lie to you. Sometimes we get caught in what I'm going to call a struggle loop, where some unforeseen thing happens. The death of a loved one. Loss financially. Just something rocks your boat and you're feeling more insecure and insignificant than you've ever felt. It's something that we didn't plan for. We could never plan for it, and we're never prepared for it. And it leads to disappointment and outrage and anger and sadness and depression at times. And at times it leads us to shame. But know this, God hasn't designed that season of your life to bring you to shame. Because we're told that God, through suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope, and hope does not put us to shame because God's love has been poured out into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us. Now look, some of us are given Satan credit for the struggle that we find ourselves in, when all the while God is, all he wants to do is use that struggle to secure your soul. So let me ask you this. Which way is your soul facing? Is it facing your struggle, or is it facing the God who is walking with you through your struggle to secure your soul? Has your soul been taken captive by your struggle, or has it been set free through Jesus' victory? Is your soul facing the pain of your past or the promise of your future in Jesus? Look, I'm convinced that God designs the struggles in our lives to show us that all the things we've turned to satisfy our souls, the satisfaction that we've looked to in success, in money, in power, in relationships, the love and affirmation that we've turned to try to find in the words that people say, in the way that people wrap their arms around us, is only ever fully present in Jesus Himself. Because look, God doesn't just design your struggle, He meets you in the middle of it. And He doesn't just meet you in the middle of it, He absolutely endures the whole of it. Jesus endures our struggle. So in Isaiah 43, verse 2, God makes a promise, a huge and lofty, crazy promise. And here's what He says. He says, "Do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by your name, and you are mine. I will be with you when you pass through the waters, and when you pass through the rivers, they will not overwhelm you. You will not be scorched when you walk through the fire, and the flame will not burn you." God doesn't just make promises, He delivers promises. And this promise became a reality when three Jewish exiles found themselves in Babylon, living under the rule of a tyrant in a totalitarian regime that was putting pressure on them to live a lifestyle that they knew was at odds with God. The king's name was Nebuchadnezzar, and one of the moves he made, and this is a polytheistic culture I'm talking about, so you could have worshipped anything, and everybody's okay with it. Very inclusive. Okay to worship whatever you decided to worship. But King Nebuchadnezzar had in his mind that worshiping the state of Babylon and worshiping his authority was something that people had to do. And so he erects a golden statue. He puts it in the town square and he says, "When you hear my musicians play their instruments, you flock." If you live in Babylon, you flock to the town square. You bow at the foot of this statue and you worship my authority as king, and you worship the authority of the state of Babylon. And so you can imagine this created some intense tension for everybody. But if you're polytheistic anyway and you're not really sure who you believe or what you believe, it didn't really create a lot of tension for you. You just showed out when the music played. But if you were these three Jewish refugees/exiles, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you had a decision to make, like all of Israel had to make. And most of the Jewish people complied. But these three gentlemen chose differently. And they were told, "Hey, you recant your beliefs or you die." That was the law. You worship this statue or you're thrown into a fiery furnace. And this is the same predicament that millions of people have faced who live under the oppressive arm of a totalitarian regime. This is first century Christians. This is Christians right now in certain regions of the world who are facing persecution. This is the same thing that people face when all of a sudden you experience a struggle or the strain of life, the loss of a loved one. Someone you care deeply about is far from God and you just want to see them come back to God. Moral collapse, financial failure, your inability to shake the demons of your past. Look, struggles are inevitable. What sets us apart is our response to them. So hear what these three chaps did. Here's what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had to say to old King Nebuchadnezzar. They said, "We have no need to answer you in this matter." All right, it's pretty confident, right? "Our God," and even gets more confident, "our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king." Confidence level 16, okay? But let's track along with them, because they chase that confidence with a degree of humility that is uncanny. And here's what they say: "But if not," they just said he's going to do it. And now you're like, well, wait a second. You guys teeter-tottering? Where are you going with this? "But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you set up." This is a paradoxical balance of confidence and humility. They know that God will rescue them, but they refuse to put God under any obligation to do so. They are not willing to make God comply to their agenda, but they are willing to worship God because he's God. So in essence, what they're saying to Nebuchadnezzar is, hey, we're doing this, we're taking this stand, not because we're going to get anything out of it, not because we're going to be spared. We're doing this because this is the line that God called us to walk, and our God is the true God. The aim of their actions was to honor God, not to get anything out of God. Their confidence was in God himself, not in God plus his ability to meet their agenda. So my question to us, where's our confidence? Is it in God plus something? Is it in God plus our agenda, plus our dreams, plus our hopes? Or is it in God himself? Where's our confidence? We see their confidence being placed wholeheartedly in God. And this caused Nebuchadnezzar to become unhinged. His authority was completely disarmed. And the reason is, these three men, their soul had a degree of security that you and I long for. Because here's the scoop on security. You only have true security if your soul is secure in something that cannot be taken away from you. Your soul can only be satisfied by something that cannot change, regardless of ups and downs, successes or failures, regardless of life or even death. Your soul can only find security in something that's absolute and unchangeable. And that something, my friends, is God. Only God can give your soul that sense of security. And only that type of security will disarm a king like Nebuchadnezzar. Only that type of security will disarm the struggle you're going through and allow it to strengthen you. Nebuchadnezzar was outraged at this. He was mind blown. And he said, dial it up. Dial up the furnace seven notches. He called some of his posse, had these three men bound and then thrown into the furnace. The flames, we're told, were so hot that the men who threw them into the furnace were incinerated. They were burned completely. And then the king, he did what he did. When he threw people into the furnace, he looked, and he was going to revel in his authority and his power. He thought his plan was working, but God was using his plan to mobilize God's plan, not Nebuchadnezzar's. And when Nebuchadnezzar looked into that flaming furnace, instead of hearing cries of agony and seeing bodies engulfed in flames, he didn't just see three people walking around calmly and unbound. He saw four people walking calmly, unbound, unharmed, and he was mind blown. And he said, the fourth looks like a son of the gods. So hear this. God is so amazing that he can be, his presence can be felt and seen and experienced and perceived amidst some of the craziest, most tumultuous struggles of our lives. That fiery furnace, you're talking flames that are like a gajillion degrees hot. You can't see anything but flame in the mouth of a volcano, but you can see God amidst this furnace. And the only reason those three or walking calmly unbound has nothing to do with their faith. It has everything to do with the fourth one in whom they had placed their faith, their hope, their trust, their security. So look, God says, I will be with you in the fire. And when we take a look at Jesus' life, we can begin to see the infinite lengths through which he went to walk with us through the before coming to this place that we call earth, that we navigate before entering our lives. And when we know that, we realize that in coming to us, Jesus' entire life was as if he was walking through a furnace. What we know was foreign to him compared to the glory that he was living amidst. When Jesus was born, he entered our finite, weak humanity. And all of his life, from his birth to him breathing his last breaths, he was under stress, he was amidst struggle, he was constantly misunderstood, he was rejected, he faced conflict, he felt isolation, he felt emotional distress and turmoil. He's experienced every range of emotion that you and I have ever experienced. But at the end of his life on the cross, Jesus ultimately entered our struggle, not just to be there, but to endure it. And like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, he was doled out an unjust sentence. He was executed unjustly. Jesus had not committed error or sin or fault. He was perfect. And when it came time for Jesus to enter the furnace of our affliction, he did so alone, completely by himself. My God, why have you forsaken me? And when the fire of God's wrath burned him to the core, he was alone. Because on the cross, he was making it clear that he didn't just enter our struggle, he was enduring our struggle so our souls could have absolute security. He was facing an infinitely greater struggle on his own. And in Jesus, we see that God doesn't just know about our pain and our anguish and our agony. He can fully relate to it. He's experienced the pain that we've experienced. He's walked through the rejection that we've walked through. And he does so, he meets us in love and in understanding to change who we are and to give us a security that we're never going to find anywhere else, to give us a hope that we can't find anywhere else. And when we find ourselves walking through the fiery furnace of life, know this, that fiery furnace is not intended to consume us. It's intended to strengthen us and to secure us so that we receive the goal of our faith, the salvation of our souls. In Jesus, our struggles are not meaningless. They're purposeful because God has purposed to defeat evil so exhaustively and so definitely that he enters our struggle, and through death, he defeats death itself. In Jesus, your struggle has an expiration date. It's finite. It begins and it will end. It will not last forever. It cannot consume you. It cannot control you. It cannot define you because you have been defined by the person and work of Jesus. And Jesus meets us where we are, not in spite of our struggles, but he meets us through our struggles to strengthen our faith and to secure our souls. It is through struggle that Jesus will keep us intact. Amen.